Hi there, and welcome to The Conscious Communicator, a show dedicated to helping you find your true voice, the nonviolent voice of personal responsibility and purpose, the voice that only you can speak. The reason that most of us fail to achieve our true voice is because of the false voices that occupy the mind. The voices of ego, consumption, expectation, opinion, and self-doubt rob us of our true nature, our true voice. Join me as we have a chat about inner purpose, outer passion, and finding your true voice.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Conscious Communicator. My name is Rusty. I appreciate you being with us. I wasn't here last week. I was gone back east. My grandmother, 96 and a half years old, died on her 72nd, what would have been her 72nd anniversary with her husband, Charlie May, who passed away in 92. So I was back east visiting with my family and getting a chance to say goodbye to a wonderful lady who made a huge impact on me. Has a lot to do with what we do here today in terms of being honest and taking responsibility for your own life. This is a woman who never made any excuses, grew up and through the Depression, raised her brothers after her father had passed away, and really didn't make any excuses for who she was. And I loved her very much, and I'm looking forward to having somebody on my side up there. Today we are being joined by Deborah Hill, who is the author of a book called Unlimited Life, and we're going to talk a little bit today about emotional intelligence and dealing with emotions. And Deborah has a lot of great ideas and to try and help people in dealing with that part of our lives. Deborah, welcome tonight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Sorry to hear your grandmother left. I'm glad you.
Yeah, well, like I said, it was 96 and a half. It was a wonderful run. So I think it was time for her to go back, and obviously on her anniversary, I thought that was really kind of cool.
That is special. That's special. Kind of like he was waiting for.
So, and reading through a lot of your material, it's apparent that you have a lot of education. You have 4 different degrees in health and human services, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. 4 degrees and then master's in nursing and majors in psychology and all of those. And then I have also done a lot of study on natural healing and all sorts of different types of thinking, all the religions, lots of different ways of communicating. It didn't stop. I love to learn. I really do. And in the last 15 years, I've been able to give a lot of that back, so I really appreciate it.
I'm kind of having a hard time hearing you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Is that a little better?
Yeah, that's better. And also, I noticed, I think you were a midwife also, so you've been involved in midwiving as well?
Bear with me. We are having a little problem hearing your guest. I'm not sure if your guest could speak up just a bit.
Okay, I'll try to speak up better.
Thank you.
So you were a midwife also, Deborah?
Yes, I was a certified nurse midwife. I decided I really wanted to. I was very involved in the natural health aspect of things and really loved natural births and had been to several of them, but decided to also incorporate the medical training as well. So I put the two together, and I was a nurse midwife for about 8 years.
And then now you're involved in coaching, and you're involved in helping people to, as the title of your book says, experience unlimited life. And in reading through your book, I enjoyed it very much. There's several different good ideas in there. One of the challenges that I have as a counselor and working with people, especially in domestic violence, which is an area that I work a lot in, is trying to help people to realize that those limiting beliefs that they have can be changed. We talk about it a lot, like it's almost like changing your religion sometimes, because some of those have been so ingrained. Your book kind of gives the impression that it's relatively easy to do once you recognize that. Is that your experience with most of the clients that you work with?
That it's easy to change the beliefs?
That it's easy to change the beliefs, to stop the negative thinking patterns.
I would. It's easy I wouldn't say that it's easy. It depends on the person. They're very situations. I think it's real important to recognize what that belief is and to work towards getting to the core of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, there's a difference though, that there are some people who really want to change and some people are pretty attached to it. You have to look at also, why do you like this limiting belief? How is it serving you? Maybe it's serving you to suffer. Maybe it's serving you to make you a victim in some way. But then perhaps there's a reason why you want to be a victim for not taking responsibility for yourself. That would just be one example. And so
most of the people that come to you, do you think that is your experience is that, because in my situation, these guys are mandated. So they're mandated after they've gone through this situation. Half the time they think it's their partner's fault. And so you're really kind of swimming upstream a little bit when you're dealing with some of this stuff. Most of your clients, they're coming to you and they're saying, I'm stuck. And can you give me kind of a basic example of maybe one of your clients that has come to you recently and kind of give me an idea of how they do that?
Yeah. What happens first is a person will come in and talk about one situation with a gentleman who came in and referred to me. And the first thing I do is, see, I look at them on a central level, a higher level, so to speak. I can see them in a different level, and I would talk to them in several different levels. And what I saw was that he was really stifled by a lot of energy, and that he was had a lot to offer and a lot going forward, but he was being drained. He was drained so much that he looked almost transparent because he was losing so much energy. So when he started to talk about the relationship between he and his wife and how there was a big separation, yes, he had a lot of issues, but I could also talk to him about what his issues were and what did he want in this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell him, I could also see her, and I could tell him a bit about their relationship and what was going on. And then we could talk about why he was investing so much time in this. For instance, he didn't want to fail after this long relationship. He didn't want to give up because that was important to him. And look at some of the underlying issues. So he thinks he's trying to keep this marriage together because of love. But then when you really look at it, there's underlying beliefs such as, I'm supposed to keep a marriage going forever.
Fear of failure, some of these other things that might be coming up.
Yes, fear of failure, not looking good, fear of being alone, wanting someone to be around, fear that he also had beliefs that if she was unhappy, it was his fault. And that's one of the beliefs I go over in my book, that another person's happiness is not your responsibility, that you can't fix someone.
But so many of us fall into that situation, especially with somebody that we care about, is that we tend to want to, and especially I will say this as a man, a lot of times wanting to be the responsible partner and to try and help their wife or their significant other through difficult situations, and sometimes even taking off some of that emotionality. You mentioned in your book, I believe I was reading it, talking about the idea of empathy as not being actually feeling the feeling, and you can straighten this out for me because I didn't earmark this page specifically, but not exactly, I mean, you can experience what they're experiencing, their pain, but the best way to help them is not to enter into the pain with them. Is that a correct phrasing of what you wrote in the book?
Yeah, that's very similar to, yeah. I don't know if those are the exact words, but that's the right idea. Pretty much, and you can think of it on your own terms, you know, having had, a death in your family recently, you know what it's like to have some sorrow. And then someone comes up to you and they're just distraught and just so upset. I feel so bad for you, and they're just really feeling bad. And they're coming to you, and you're dealing with your issues, and it just brings you down. So in other words, if you're feeling really hurt or really bad, and someone actually is feeling as bad as you, you both go down. What is really helpful is if the person who is trying to assist the other one really understand compassionately and empathetically what's going on in the situation, but not sympathetically. No sympathy. No going down and feeling really bad, so that you can stay in a neutral place or a happy place, an understanding place, and give them a place to come up to work up to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and you know, it was always kind of my, you know, being a school counselor as well, I work in the schools, and a lot of, you know, we're oftentimes encouraged to try and help young boys get more in touch with their emotions and to be more empathetic and those kinds of things. And one of the things that I was always concerned about was that empathy at its purest level, or I guess sympathy, the way that you described it would probably be a better word, actually would double the pain in the world. Because if you were able to really re-feel what the other person was feeling, you're magnifying that by two. And I'm not exactly sure that's a good thing. You know, I really don't see that as being the be-all, end-all of the human experience, is to get everybody to be able to feel the pain of others. Because, as you said, I don't think it's necessarily beneficial. And at some level, it's probably self-serving for the person who's sympathetic to feel like that they're being really compassionate and so forth. My father's just got remarried, I guess, about 3 months ago. My mom died of breast cancer 3 years ago. And his new wife wanted to be, she's a very nice lady, like her very much, but she wanted to be very involved in the process and try and feel the things that we felt. And it seemed odd to me because she didn't really know this lady and hadn't been a part of the life and so forth. So sometimes it also stands out as being, you know, just like you said, it doesn't make sense. And I don't think it necessarily helps. You wrote the book, you're doing the coaching. Can you give me some of the reasons why, and you mentioned being able to read people and their energy levels and so forth. Was there a period in your life where you began to realize that you had a different skill set that you wanted to do other than the nursing?
I've always had, I've been through many professions, so I've always had, since I was a child, the ability to hear things and see things that other people didn't, know things. But as a child, I was not supported in that, and I was told that it wasn't real, that the things that I saw were not real. When my grandfather came to visit me after he died, that, no, I wasn't seeing my grandfather. And I was started to feel very weird and strange and didn't want to, I wanted to fit in, and so I felt like I was some sort of freak. So what I did was I invalidated my own abilities. But I could still feel things and know things and hear things that other people couldn't hear. And I guess I was a closet clairvoyant for most of my life. Until about 15 or 16 years ago, somebody told me, I read this book about psychic abilities and realized that I had most of them. And I know it's kind of strange, but I knew I was able to do this, but I just didn't really admit it to myself, and I didn't see the benefit that I could have with other people. So I took many, many, many classes and workshops, and when I did that, I was able to really use that ability in a whole different way. However, I feel that it's real important for people just to not hear things, and all the counseling that I've done and my nursing and stuff. I know people have to talk through things, not just have things put out in front of them. And so then I evolved my business more into coaching and counseling without them having to fill out all the paperwork and forms and us spend, you know, months or whatever figuring out what's wrong with them, where we just get right to the point.
Now, are you able to do most of your work over the phone? Is that correct? Most of your client sessions are done over the phone?
I can do work over the phone, and I can also, I have people come here in person. It depends on the preference from where they are. I have people who just love to come see me, and so they come here, and I have people who I've been seeing, so to speak, for years, but I've never actually seen them in person.
So anybody that's out there, remember, you can call anytime if you have a question for Deborah. We're at 888 228 4494, and that's in the U.S. and Canada. Toll free worldwide, 877-489-6350. One of the things that I read, and it was part of the bio that you sent me, reveal how to control your feelings and discover your inner truth. I mean, that's interesting. You talk about controlling your feelings. Can you give me a little bit more insight on that?
Well, the way I see it is we are this essential being. We have a certain awareness that it makes up us. We are a being that is not the body, mind, or emotions. And while perhaps control your emotions is not exactly correct, but control yourself from reacting according to your emotions might be a better explanation of it. You can learn to release a lot of emotions, to understand other things that other people are saying. There are many ways to deal with emotions or to express the emotions if this is what you really want to do. I give people ways to make choices. Another thing that you brought up, you know, when people are feeling sympathy, and if you go to a very sympathetic level and you really start to feel someone else's pain, energetically you're picking up that pain in your own body, in your field. And it's very difficult to get rid of that pain, and you might feel a lot of emotions from that. And it's harder to get rid of emotions that aren't yours. So I also teach people how to release and clear their space of emotions that they've picked up that aren't theirs.
Can you give us an example of how somebody might do that? If you give somebody a tool as to how to kind of clear their space?
Sure. The first thing... One thing to notice is if you're feeling something and you keep trying to fix it and it's not working within yourself, then it's probably not yours. Because you know how to fix what's ever yours. And so that would mean that there's somebody else's energy in your space. I teach in my classes a grounding exercise, and it would take a little while to talk through this whole thing. But one thing that someone could do is just to center themselves and ground themselves and to imagine a wind of, say, blue-gold light passing through from above and cleaning out their whole system, going from the top of their head through their body and then emanating around their whole aura and cleaning it out and making a commitment to let go of anything that is not theirs.
We also, and you had mentioned a lot about feelings. You talked a lot about that in your book as well. What is your, you know, and again, coming at it from a male perspective and being left-brained that I am,
mm-hmm.
What is your feel? As kind of coming at this world from the cognitive behavioral model of thinking creates emotions, what do you think about emotions? Are those just, let me leave it at that. What do you think about emotions? Are those natural human characteristics that we must hold to be super important? What's your feeling on emotions in general?
Emotions, I feel that what I see is that we have, like I said, these four aspects of self. There's the essential awareness self, there's the body, mind, and emotions. And emotions is like a body in itself. It's a part of the being, and it's a combination of the body. It's very influenced by the body. It's very influenced by spirit. It's influenced by all these different things. So it's acting in its own. It's its own entity. It's not created by the mind. And the mind wants to define emotions and understand the emotions and figure them out and wants to manipulate the emotions. But the mind can't, because the mind is not the emotions. The emotions are very different. They're made of a different substance. It's like an oil and water thing. The two can't really touch. You can notice with your mind that that's happening again. And you may have, with your mind, find that there are certain things that you could say to your on an emotional level that might comfort you or help you in some way, and saying those words might help your emotions to feel better. You might notice with your mind that at certain times when you're doing certain activities or you say certain things that you experience certain emotions, and you can make a choice whether you want to do that again. But you cognitively controlling your emotions is kind of like a monkey trying to grab one of those slippery, they had these slippery toys that wherever you hold it, it would just slip through your hand and fall. It can't happen.
What about the idea that thoughts create emotion, though? I mean, I think it's, you know, at least in my world, it's very apparent to me that when we have a thought, the thought is a generation point for the emotion. And again, going back to relationships and in my field of work, we deal a lot with jealousy and things like that. Those emotions necessarily are thought generated. I mean, you may be experiencing jealousy from some place, but I don't know that are we talking about emotions here as general moods? I mean, it's like you wake up and you kind of have an overwhelming sense of whatever, or are we talking about specific individual feelings? Because in my thought process, thoughts create emotions. Thoughts create feelings. If I see my girlfriend with some other man and my thoughts instantly go to some place, I can create jealousy in myself. If on the other hand, I see my girlfriend with some other person and my thoughts go in a different direction, I don't create that emotional state. So I don't know if I'm with you on that in terms of, are you talking about emotional states overall or specific feeling states?
I'm talking about emotions and as feelings. I'm not defining them because it is a feeling state. And when you talk about jealousy, there's two components. There's an intellectual component and a feeling component. And your intellectual, your belief, and your what you see and how you see that and respond to that. If you look at your girlfriend with somebody else, there are many different ways that you can respond to that. Some people would feel fear. Some people would feel jealousy. Some people would feel pain. Some people would feel relief. They would want to move on. It all depends on what you think at that time. And what
that's
you believe
point,
you're
that,
supposed
and
to
that
have.
Kind of, to me, that to me strikes me as the crux that where I think I may differ from a lot of people in the emotional arena because of the fact those beliefs that you talk about, those are firmly entrenched mind patterns, ways of thinking, thoughts that have been created over time, repetitive, negative, you know, engrams, whatever you want to call them, stuff that you need to clean out. The stuff that your book speaks so specifically to, those 16 or 18 limiting beliefs. But those are thoughts. Those are thought systems. And those complex thought systems created from our very earliest times create the emotional states that we assume are these wonderful human experiences. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, I have this wonderful feeling of whatever it happens to be. The fact that my grandmother passed away last week and my experience of that, being very close to her and being a part of her life, especially for the last 20 years since my grandfather passed, I didn't experience sadness per se or a great sense of loss. What I really had was a real sense of awe in terms of what she experienced and so forth. But those were thoughts. And I'm kind of interested in that, you know, especially the way your book talks about it, because these limiting belief systems are in fact thoughts in the first place, aren't they?
The beliefs are patterns, they're thoughts that are ingrained. It's even deeper, it's more on a subconscious level. It's a pattern, an energetic thought pattern that you have.
Right.
And you believe it in all levels. But it is, yes, more thought generated. And you say that it's ingrained and it's not going to be fixed, but there is a place where you can get to the point of, where did this happen? Why do I feel this way? And you can change that thought. You can repattern it. And well, that
I'm
thought
I'm gonna read
will
your
create
book again, because I'm working on that part for myself.
Uh-huh.
I think I've gotten to the place for me where I can be aware of the thoughts. You know, I think Freud really, the subconscious mind has been used as a large kind of a dumping ground for all these things. I'm not sure that they might be below our conscious level, but we do have the ability to bring them into light, and I think that's what you and your book are talking about. You bring them up to the mm-hmm. surface so you can see them. I now can see them. They're still there. I still have a lot of negative thoughts. I just don't buy into them like I used to. You know,
right.
When I hear myself, at the end of a long day, and I've done whatever I've done that day, and I've had a very busy day, and I've seen clients, and I've done classes, and I've done this, that, and the other, and I can't lay my head down on the pillow without some sense that I didn't do enough that day. You know, that negative voice just saying, enough's not enough.
Yeah.
And I can see it now, but what I don't do anymore is I don't buy into it. You know, it's not like I listen uh-huh. to it and go, oh, you know what, you're right, I should have had a better day, and then I feel bad and I can't go to sleep. Now I just see it, and I go, well, that's interesting. You know, I hear myself thinking that. So the tapes, it's not like I erased them, but they're aware. I'm aware of them now, you know. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I look at it like you are an aware person. You have an objective viewpoint at that point. And you're aware and you're watching your thoughts going. And I see the thoughts and the emotions as sort of employees. They work really well for us, the ego as well. They all work really well, and they all have their jobs. You know, the mind is very rational and intelligent. It gives us a lot of information. The feelings, you know, help to color our life and give more understanding and blend in more and go on and on. But anyways, there are lots of different qualities that each have, but we are not the emotions, and we are not the thoughts, and we are not the ego. So you can, you know, have your employee come in and say, well, you know, you didn't do enough work today. And, you know, you can say, well, thanks for sharing, and I really appreciate it. And, you know, I'm busy right now. Can you just come on? I'll talk to you later.
Can you bug me tomorrow, later today?
That's right, you know.
Well, what,
you can't even convince them that it's different.
I earmarked this was when we exist in a place of neutrality, we're able to see all of life in a relaxed and easy manner. And that, you know, that jumped out at me. And I, you know, mm-hmm. I tend to be, again, and I fall back on my male sword all the time in terms of dealing with some of these issues. But I tend to think about that neutrality or kind of that detached rational approach as being, maybe it's just because that's where I'm comfortable, but it also does seem to be the place where a lot of the problem solving gets done in the world.
Yes, and I would say it's detached, but it's not always rational.
Mm-hmm.
Rational is, in fact, logical is one of the things I say. Not everything is logical. It's just being in a state of awareness. You're kind of empty. You're not thinking anything or paying attention to the person who's thinking. And you're noticing what you're feeling, though you're not identifying with it. You see, if you need to take care of something, if there's some part of you that's really unhappy about something, then you need to do something different with your life so that can be fixed, or well, maybe something you ate sometimes will make you feel bad. It's sad.
Had a bad burrito, that's all that was. How do you convince somebody that that's just not their, I mean, say for example they feel, you know, I've got this big empty hole in my life, I don't know what it is or where it's coming from, and the reality is you look at their life and it seems like it's actually pretty valid, and they're, you know, they're living a life and they're doing what they can do, and they're achieving at a level that's probably pretty comfortable to what they're doing, and at some level maybe that's a thought process in and of itself that's saying that you're not doing enough. I mean, do you find that people sometimes are just too judgmental of themselves, and they don't really realize that they're not, in fact, happy? They may just be maybe bored or something else is kind of, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. And what I'm finding is if you're feeling that there's a hole, the hole, like 98, 99, maybe 100%, I've never seen it not be this way, but there may be situations where it is. Normally, okay, I'll name one situation in a little while that it could be, but normally that hole is you're not there. There
you're
is.
You're not present in that part of your
you're
life.
You're not present enough in your life to fill you up. You don't feel enough of your own self-love. You don't create enough joy in each moment because you're not really consciously, groundedly there. And if you're really here and you're really paying attention and aware, there is no space for a hole. You might get a little bored, so then you'll do something else. Or you say, well, okay, so I'm bored, that's, you know. But normally, and then the next step, if you're bored, say, well, what do I want to create in my life? What would make me happy? And then you create something to fill in that space. The only other time I actually have seen, well, there's a void, is with someone who's been with someone for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and that person leaves. There's a hole. And they have allowed that person to be such a part of their life that they've kind of filled in each other's auras with, and so there's a period of time where they have to relearn how to fill in their own space while still keeping the love in their heart for that person. So there's it's lonely is what that hole is, but missing that person. So I have seen that happen, but more than, and I'm seeing it a lot where people are coming to me and saying, I'm very successful, my kids are great, everything is great, and something's wrong. And what they've been doing is they've been listening to their mind, to their ego, to what they were supposed to do for all these years. They've had their sword out, they've won the battle, but they forgot who they were. And I get them back to where they are now and remember parts of themselves that they left behind. Bring them back so that they can be full again.
It sounds so much like my father after my mom died. I mean, that 3-year period of time was basically he disappeared. I mean, those two were connected at the hip. We're a military family, and that was part of it. Also, probably somewhat of an enmeshed relationship as I look at it now. But, you know, in my mind, it was a successful marriage of almost 40 years, but it was as if my father, there was something that was so primary to him that disappeared, and now with his new wife, he kind of wants that same sort of relationship with his children, with his new wife. He's trying to kind of force that level of intimacy with his new wife, and it's really uncomfortable to watch, and he's even, you know, to the point now where his religion, he's trying to fill that gap with his religion again. He's become almost... I'd say that my father was a pre-Vatican II Catholic to begin with, and now I would think if he was able to speak in Latin, he would do it nonstop. I mean, he has really turned to his faith as a way of trying to justify or guide his existence now that he's no longer, you know, working or doing anything else. And a lot of what you speak to sounds very much like what he's experiencing. What do you say to somebody that's dealing with those thoughts? I know a lot of people right now struggling out there with watching their 401ks. My brother-in-law, for example, who's 58 and was hoping to retire at 60, has watched his portfolio lose, you know, 50% of its wealth, and he's got 3 kids under the age of 12, and he's thinking about college funds and stuff, and he talks about just not being able to shut off the mind when he tries to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
How do you help somebody to shut those voices down or to try and at least become comfortable enough with them so that they can go to sleep at night?
Well, there's many things to look at. I like to look at what are the beliefs, you know. I wrote a paper on this and had it. I can redistribute it, but you know, there's this belief the sky is falling, and what we're doing is we're seeing what's happening now and projecting it into the future. So we're projecting doom into the future, and yes, it looks really horrible right now. However, some of the things that I look at is everything happens for a reason. And I have yet to find a situation where that's not true. And there's usually a reason, it's a good reason for that happening, so that you're learning something and you're growing. And you'll always be taken care of. You look at yourself, you look at how you've made it this far, and say, I'm going to continue to do that. So don't lose faith in yourself to create the situation. In this particular time, this is an incredible time. It's a really difficult time. But we're making a huge transition. We're going to change a lot of not just economics in the entire world, but we're coming together as globally, working together for the first time. We're going to start changing values. We're going to start changing the way we do business and the way we relate to people. We're going to get more back to basics and start having fewer holes in our lives and being more who we are and valuing our time together. And I know that sounds really nice, but, you know, during this period, there's when you make a big change, the transition times are tough. So you just, everybody's going through it, though. So everyone says, yeah, but I love, and you have these ideas that all these other people are going to be okay. But everything's going to shift. College tuitions will have to shift. Housing's going to shift. Things are already cheaper to buy. Everything's going to work itself out so that we're all at the same level. There's very few people who are falling out, and we are, as a nation and as a individuals and as a world, we're going to figure it out. This is a really good time to start visualizing what you want to have happen in your life. So when you're having these thoughts of fear, start instead putting out pictures of how you want your life to be in the future. Start visualizing it, because you create from the now. And if you put that out, then you can start making that happen. And I think that's so important for all of us to do that, is to visualize how we really want the world to be. Because right now is a really good time to do it. Things are so tense. And if you ever notice that when you're at your worst, when you're most afraid, that's when you have your most power to change. And we can create a lot of change now, and it's good to really think about where we want to go. So take that fear and try and turn it around with your beliefs and realize, I'm going to be okay. And also, be in the moment. Don't worry about the future. The future doesn't exist. We have no idea what's going to happen in the next year, 2 years, 2 months. We really don't know. People can't even predict what the stock market's going to do from the morning to the night. So the only way to really be at peace is to be here right now. And right now you can deal with it. Right now everything's okay. The money's in the bank, it's paper, it's theoretical, and it can go up or down, and things can and will eventually go back up.
Yeah, it's kind of like watching the price of gas. I think we were all convinced that it was going to be $4 a gallon. There's a bunch of older people my age or older out there riding scooters right now going, I wish I hadn't bought this stupid scooter now that gas is back down below $2 in some places and people are, you know, back driving their cars. And, you know, 6 months ago we were all concerned that that was going to be the biggest thing. And, you know, I think that present moment awareness is something that runs through everybody that I think that's been on this show has mentioned at some point the idea of present moment awareness and trying to stay focused, because, you know, when you think about thoughts and you think about emotions and so forth, that's generally what happens is we get outside of what's here, what's right in front of us, and we start thinking about what ifs or what thens or what could I have done different, and that's when we really get ourselves into trouble. So I know that's great advice, but I tell you, you know, I've got a guest, it's a husband and wife couple that are coming on in a couple weeks. And their book is called Working on Yourself Doesn't Work. But they talk about the idea of, you know, you really have to stop, you know, trying to work on yourself or even fighting against some of these things and just to be present. And the idea is it's instantaneous transformation once you do it, which I agree with. But at the same time, you have to do it all the time. I mean, you have to be aware. When I talk about my dog Jake on the show a lot because he's the other half of my world, but you know, walking him every day, there are times when I notice that I'm really present and I'm there and I'm walking my dog, and then there's other times I'm thinking about, well, I got to do this today, or I need to do that, or I need to do that, and I completely miss the walk. You know, I can go for 45 minutes or an hour, and I don't remember anything. And it's really frustrating. But, you know, I think that if this consciousness shift that's going on right now is happening, it's the beginning of the understanding that we are, in fact, or we need to be in control of that faculty of thought. You know, the consciousness, whatever gift that is, it's been given to us. It's not something that can just be accepted without some responsibility. And that responsibility is we have to be in control of our thoughts. We have to really pay attention to the way that we exist and the way that we think, because that has such a huge impact on the now. And if we do think it long enough, you probably will create the future. You tend to create
absolutely.
Those things you think about.
And the more, the better you get at it, the more aware you get, and the more conscious you are of your thoughts, the more center you are, and the more present you are, the more power you have. And you'll find that you think something and it immediately happens. So
right.
You'll get to a certain point where you got to be careful what you think, because it will happen.
Now, I'm reading down through your blog, and if you don't mind me mentioning, I know you put it on your blog, so you wouldn't, because my mother was experiencing it as well. You're going through some cancer therapy yourself?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Can you speak to that a little bit? That must be quite a challenge.
It was. It was quite a surprise. Found out in, it started the end of June of this year, and I won't go into great depth, but I was a person who I've meditated and been a runner and work out with weights and exercise and eat really healthy and have all my life. So it was, I just didn't think it could happen to me. So I've learned quite a lot, and had a bilateral mastectomy, and also I'm now going through chemotherapy. I'm very fortunate because mine was a slow-growing cancer with a low reoccurrence, but we still have to make sure that we've gotten all of it, and then I'll take medication for 5 years to make sure that it doesn't come back. And it's been very challenging, and you talk about, you know, the emotions and the thoughts, and if I could think about, why is this happening to me? This is terrible. I'm not going to make it. You know, I get into that thought pattern, and it's really can be unpleasant. And then they'll bring the emotions down to this level of poor me, and that's very hard to come out of. So I've really been, I feel that everything happens for a reason, and I've been taking advantage of this opportunity to learn a lot. And I don't recommend it, but it has been tremendously growthful. If you can do this some other way, do that. but you really do change and you really do grow. And I'm actually have a blog that I'm doing at pinkmagazine.com.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to the blogs and go to breast cancer blog, I talk about my experience and the lessons that I've learned and the things that I'm experiencing. And I'm not the same person that I was last June. I just call it BC. It's like before breast cancer, everything is just a blur. It's just all one thing. And then afterwards, my whole world changed.
Well, it's amazing. I appreciate you sharing with us. You know, I do so much work with kids, and that's kind of my focus. I get to work with the guys, mostly men, some women we work with in the domestic violence arena, who have obviously gotten to a point in their life where it's become apparent to everybody that they're having some struggles. But most of my work is with kids. I work a lot in elementary schools. I do a lot of public speaking in elementary schools. And that poor me mentality that I think a lot of times happens to kids who have experienced suffering, I work with foster kids quite a bit. How do you try? Do you work at all with kids? Have you had any success helping them in those areas?
I don't have kids specifically coming in for counseling on that with those issues, though I do talk to a lot of people who, you know, their inner child did have that problem. And it's difficult to get to that person, back to that point, but what happens is if you point out that this is where it's all coming from, or get them to remember what that was like, then their inner child experiences this, it's this fear. And it's very sad because as a child, we, one, feel responsible for what our parents are doing and what other people do. We think that it's our fault if something like that happens. And we also have no control. So it's real important for people to remember or realize when you're little, you don't understand a lot. And you're not causing it. It's that person's problem. And that when you grow up, or, you know, if you can, you know, as a child, you can get other people to help you. But when they're already a grown up, you can say, can you see now how, as a child, you were helpless because you're so little? But you're grown up now, and that's not going to happen again. And that's very comforting and very healing for someone to bring all that to present time as an adult. Also, it's important, and it's hard for children to see because they don't have enough understanding. If you could somehow teach them to be objective, looking at their parents, then you could see it like an adult would see it. And you see someone acting like that, and you say, that person has some problems. He's really upset, he's in pain, he's out of control, or he's alcoholic, or, and you can have some compassion, because a lot of times those people are doing that because of the inner pain and turmoil that they have. And then that can help you to separate from it and not be as angry, at least understanding, and then heal yourself from that as well.
Yeah, we talk a lot with the adults about reparenting your inner child and realizing mm-hmm. that for most of these guys that they were victims at one point in their life, and that, you know, unfortunately that seems to happen, is that we cycle back and we end up victimizing somebody else. You know, we repeat the patterns of the past, and it's uncomfortable. With the kids, it's such a challenge to get them to disconnect from that and to understand. I think you're right. One of the things that I speak to them about a lot is really trying to separate themselves from what's happening. But, you know, when they're in the amygdala part of the brain and they're so emotionally centered, you know, it's so difficult until the age of 24 or 25 when they get into the rational part of the brain and the cortex area where they can start to think things out and disconnect themselves from life experiences. But by that time, mm-hmm. you know, like I said, and I'm sure it's probably laziness and like a lot of pattern beliefs or addictive behaviors is basically laziness, but it just seems like it's almost like learning a new language. You know, it's so easy to say, you know, be present, change your thoughts, do this, do that. But the reality of it is that we tend to we revert back to those thought patterns of the past, and you know, we fall back into those traps. You know, it is a daily thing. You know, it's a daily reminder. I'm sure in your situation, you have to remind yourself on a daily basis not to fall into those traps.
Right. We all have our issues that we're working through, and you wonder, why did I have that experience as a child? Why did that have to happen to me? And, you know, I felt very, very unsupported. I, thank God, was not abused when I was a child, but I was emotionally abused. And I felt very disconnected from everybody and very unsupported and very sad. And I always longed for a family that really supported me and understood me and played with me, you know, and we were all friends. And it never happened. What happened is I ended up really just sort of taking over for myself, using my gifts, connecting with a higher self, being really self-sufficient, and developing my own power. So, in a sense, that's what I needed to do. That was a lesson that I had to learn, and my family situation was perfect to teach me that.
There's a lot of people that believe that we pick our parents before we come here in the first place for that very reason. You know, we have a certain, goal of what we want to become. And, you know, my father, for example, my mother and I were extremely close. My father and I really have never, we were close, and I love my dad dearly, but he still to this day doesn't understand my emotionality or some of the things that, and I felt kind of the same way. You know, I was a very sensitive kid, and those are things that really just didn't resonate with him. And, you know, for a long time I wished that I had something different, but in hindsight I realized that that was the oven in which I was baked, and I probably chose that for that very reason to become the person I am today. We know when we talk a lot today about the indigo children. Have you heard about the indigos, or I guess they're calling them now the crystals, and some of these kids that supposedly have some intuitive powers that are coming to help us through this next evolution of consciousness? Are you familiar at all with those ideas?
Yes, I am.
And what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that, because a lot of times I go into schools and I'm surrounded by kids and I'm like, I wish I could find some indigos, you know, hoping we can get these kids to stop eating crayons and playing video games and get them to the point where they realize they have these tremendous gifts that we want them to share. What's your feeling on the indigos and the crystals?
What I'm seeing, and I like to look at children, I love to look at kids in the eye and see who they are and where they're going. And, you know, children, they have to be children. They have to act like babies and burp and, you know, poop in their diapers and stuff. And they have to run around and be, you know, act like two-year-olds when they're two. But if you look in their eyes and you see their spirit, I'm noticing that the kids these days have a certain clarity and a presence that I haven't seen before. And I've been seeing this for about, personally, 8 or 10 years. When I hear about indigo kids and crystal kids, you know, I hear it enough that I don't deny that that's happening. People have defined that there's a certain group, and that might be true. To be honest, I have not really looked that hard to define that's an indigo person and that's a crystal child. But I have looked, and I have noticed an evolution in different types of people coming down here. And I'm seeing in the teenagers them having awareness, and you can talk to them, and they are, or I'll talk to my 24-year-old nephew, and I have to be really clear and straight with him. I can't, you know, drift off. I have to be very present because he has a real presence. And I see that in the children as well. They may be acting out a certain way, but they do have a certain presence that's going to develop and evolve, and they're going to do things that we never thought of or dreamed possible. So you can't make, they still have to come to Earth and learn the ropes, you know. They're going to go through puberty, the whole thing. And they're going to have to learn how to get along. But there's an essential awareness within them that doesn't go away, a sensitivity. I was thinking about it yesterday. I used to call my website Your Intuitive Life, and I've changed it to the Awareness Initiative. Because when you talk about intuition and clairvoyant and psychic abilities, it seems like a separate thing. They call it a sixth sense. But it isn't a sixth sense, it's an awareness. It's a consciousness and being aware of the outside and being aware of the inside to such a degree that you pick things up that other people who aren't doing that don't pick that up. I feel like these children are very aware.
Yeah, but I like what you say too, because that's one of the things I think for me, in my presentations and stuff, I also help them to understand the fact that they are going to have to learn the ropes. I mean, there's a sense that a lot of them want to, you know, why do I have to come to school, or why do I have to do this? And it's like, you know what, I'm hoping, you know, this Barack Obama election, I think, has been part of the shift in consciousness, but it's, you know, and regardless of your politics, it was a major statement in terms of racial equality or whatever else, but I think it's also a realization of the fact that this is a person, regardless of color or whatever else, that had gone through the challenges of you know, paying for his own education and raising himself up through, you know, the levels of, you know, racism or whatever he had to deal with. And the fact of the matter is that these kids want to say, you know, we don't need this. We don't need school. We don't need this. We don't need that. Well, I think that's not right. I think they do need that. They do need to learn how it works. And then from that, to take their intuition and make, you know, make those systems better or, you know, create new systems. But it can't just be a free-for-all. You know, when we have some parents out there just think, you know, my kid's got this intuition and I just need to follow the intuition. I think the kids really need structure. I think they need structure within which to blossom. And that's a hard message to get out there and carry to those kids.
It reminds me of Helen Keller for some reason. You know, how if she was just this wild, crazy child, and she was blind and deaf, and so she was just, she had all this inherent ability no one knew about. It took structuring her to make her learn to sit still, to learn words, to identify what's happening in the world, learn manners, and to bring that energy into body and see, you have to learn how to use that energy and how the world works so you can use your energy within the world.
Right.
Until she
kind of
figured
out the Matrix. And I talked to them about their video games. You know, their video games are completely rule-based. And they're, oh, no, they're not. And I'm like, yeah, they're absolutely rule-based. It's if yes this, if no that. And they're 100% rule-based. And, you know, they want to think of it as this free-flowing, you know, existence in the cyber world. But the truth of the matter is that it's incredibly rule-based. And we have to give them some structure and some way of expressing those talents that they have, the inherent talents that they have available to them, so that they can be beneficial to themselves and to other people.
That's
we got about 3 minutes left. Do you have a success story or something, more information that you want to share with the listeners about where they can find out more about you and your what your work and what you're doing?
Wow, a success story. I have a lot of success stories, and there are success stories or a lot of testimonials on my website. My website is theawarenessinitiative.com, and you can buy my book there, Unlimited Life, Limiting Beliefs, and Belief-Busting Power Truths, and I've got methods for how you can change your beliefs, find them and change them and change your life. And then I talk about 16 different beliefs that a lot of us have that don't work and then how you can change those. I've been doing coaching and counseling for a very long time, and I'm doing it because I love it. I love to watch people change and grow. So it's a lot of fun, and you can find out on my website. My phone number's there, or you can email me at debhill@theawarenessinitiative.com.
Well, I really appreciate your time. I know you're 3 hours ahead of us. We're in California, so it's 11, almost, I guess, 12 o'clock your time now.
12 o'clock.
And I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us, and I wish you good luck in your ongoing battle. Obviously, my mom was battled for 6 years herself, and you know, I think she made the decision that it was time for her to go, and I've always said she gave birth to me twice, because the second time when she left, it was her way of saying, hey, you know, hey boy, you can take care of it yourself from here. And I still appreciate that, and she's with me every day, and I appreciate the work you're doing and all the things
Thank you very much tonight
and for joining us. So for all the guests, for all the listeners out there, again, you know, I have your other website up as well, so I've got yourintuitivelife.com, but theawarenessinitiative.com, debhill@theawarenessinitiative.com. If you have any additional questions, you can always email us here at the show as well at consciouscommunicator@hotmail.com. Deb, thank you very much. I hope you have a great
evening.
Thank you.
It was really a pleasure talking to you. I appreciate you having me on. Yeah, there's a lot of great questions. I really love talking to you.
Good. Have a great evening.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you, Dawn.
We've come to the end of another hour here at the Conscious Communicator, and I can't thank you enough for joining me on this journey. Your phone calls and emails are greatly appreciated, and if you like what we're doing, please invite a friend to join us. This is a conversation that needs many voices, and as we open up the possibility of conscious communication to more and more people, the results will be a freeing of the true self from the burdensome armor of ego, and a flowering of the potential that is available to all of us. Until next time, peace out, travelers. The rest is still unwritten.